Hello, everybody, and welcome to yet another edition of Forgotten Horror Classics. And tonight, we are going to be featuring the wonderful Legend of Boggy Creek from 1972 by the director Charles B. Pierce. And I know this is a movie that I have seen and loved and treasured from when I was a little kid. Of course, now as an adult, I can definitely see all the flaws. But it was still a pretty cool movie to me. Tonight I am here with...
Lenore.
Hello, Lenore. And I'm also here with...
Gaz Morgan.
How's it going, Gaz?
It's good, sir.
And I know Miss Lenore has not seen this film before, correct?
Yeah.
And Gary? I don't remember if you
have. I have a few times.
A few times.
Wait.
Lenore was riveted, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Is your name Gaz or Gary? I thought it was Gary.
Well, for my podcast, I go by Gaz, so that's what I put it on then.
Oh, okay.
There you go. So, yes, several of us have seen it before. This was Lenore's first time. One of the reasons I wanted to do this film, in addition to being a movie that I used to love as a kid, is the fact that there are a number of people, especially in the younger generation, who have never seen this film and who don't quite realize its importance in as far as Abominable Snowman / Yeti movies or Bigfoot films. And it's very important, and so we will get to that discussion and discussion of the movie right after we hear these spooky sounds. So we'll be right back. Okay, and we are back. So, before we get into the background, what did you guys think, Miss Lenore?
To be honest, up until the end, it was a little sleepy.
Okay, I can understand that.
I get that, too. I mean, it was sleepy people they were interviewing. Right, so,
right.
You know, it can only move as fast as the story and the people in it.
Right, right.
Like you, I remember it from being a kid and watching it with my parents on the big console television or something, you know?
Right, right.
Probably next to a window, which even freaked me out
and
more.
It's a little different for you, too, because just to give you guys some context, this movie is shot in such a way as a kind of a sort of in documentary style, but it's a mix of things that happen supposedly with dramatizations and things that didn't happen. So... and it uses a lot of local people as either themselves or playing local actors playing some characters. So you get a lot, and it was shot in the place where this was all happening. So the verisimilitude is quite strong in this film. And basically this is because when the incidents that happened in 1971 came out, Charles B. Pierce decided he wanted to go to Texarkana or to the Falk area, because this is about the Falk monster. He was in Shreveport at the time, and he wanted to do a documentary, so he went there, and then it turned into this whole film.
I'm pretty sure that's the only time that Falk had an industry.
Probably.
Was during the making of this film.
Probably. But if people who are younger, they don't quite get it because of the way that it's shot. This style of pseudo-documentary thing wasn't really done for a while. And then, of course, Blair Witch Project came out, and that kind of reinvented the whole thing, because Blair Witch is shot very, very similar. You know, more modern technology, of course, with you know, modern digital audio tapes and high-definition digital cameras and everything. But it's very much along the same line, sort of tracking down a local legend and getting themselves physically invested into it. So if you don't really have that background, it kind of doesn't really make a big difference to you. But those of us who are older and have seen these things, especially because, you know, most of the Bigfoot movies, the ABSM movies that came out, especially in the 70s and 80s, were mostly garbage. I mean, they're all just standard monster movies with terrible masks. This movie's not really like this. This is more of like a nature documentary almost. But let me get into some of the background. So, The Legend of Boggy Creek was made in 1972 by a man named Charles B. Pierce. Charles B. Pierce was a guy who worked in television in Shreveport. He was sort of like a set decorator, and he did a whole bunch of other things. I think he actually was a weatherman for a while in Shreveport. He hosted a kiddie show. He was Mayor Chuckles on this, like... Mayor Chuckles on this local TV show for kids. And so he kind of comes from this background of television. He worked on some of Jack Hill's productions. He was a set director on Kofi in 1973 and Foxy Brown in 1974. So he's got some background in the film. And in 1972, he decided he was going to make this film. So he managed to talk to somebody in one of the local trucking companies to invest some money, something like $100,000. And the actual budget for this film, I believe, is $162,000. Then he goes, he makes the film, and it ends up grossing over $25 million. So for a movie that was pretty much created as a drive-in theater to capture the stuff that was just happening in 1971, he made an awful lot of money. And in fact, he was able to go on and bankroll a number of other films. So Charles B. Pierce is known as the director of Bootlegger in 1974, Winter Hawk in 1975, a very, very good film called The Town That Dreaded Sundown in 1976 with Don Wells. In fact, it was recently remade, and it's one of the few movies that I can honestly say the remake is just as good, if not better. I definitely recommend that one. He also did a movie called The Norseman in 1978, which was kind of a crappy movie. That was was where you get to see Lee Majors playing a Viking. I remember that from back then. Oh, I know.
It's Lee Majors.
Yeah, Lee Majors, the $6 million man. Married to Farrah Fawcett Majors. It's before your time.
Okay.
Like twice before your
time. I know.
We're very old.
He did a good movie called The Evictors, 1979. Sacred Band in 1983. And then he ended up coming back and doing Boggy Creek 2 in 1984. And then a couple other films that kind of went away. He also, you might be interested in this, Gary, he was a writer and he wrote the first draft of Sudden Impact, the Dirty Harry movie from 1983. And as a matter of fact, the line, go ahead, make my day, was his line.
Wow.
And there's a funny story about that. Apparently,
he heard it first from a Sasquatch.
No.
Texarkana.
He heard it from his dad. His dad would always tell him that he had to mow the lawn. And he'd always come back and say, if you didn't mow the lawn when I got back, you'll make my day. Because he was like, you'll make my day because I get to, you know, spank you. Yeah.
Oh, it's nice you look forward to something.
Yes. So, yeah. So that's kind of where he's coming from. There's no real star in the film because, like I said, a lot of these people are locals or they were people playing themselves.
I mean, I guess the creature is the star.
The creature is kind of the star.
The legs.
The legs.
The furry legs. Yeah. The star. And the guy that lived in the shack down by the river.
And frankly, I think he did a very wise decision because that's one of the problems with some of the later Boggy Creek movies is that you can see all too well that they're crappy costumes.
Right.
You know, in this movie, you're only seeing shadows. You're seeing it from far away.
They were creepy.
They were creepy. You
know, even though they were like 100 yards away.
Right.
It was the not knowing.
Right.
That really.
Right.
That's. I think that's a shooting style that's not utilized enough.
Exactly, these days.
That subtle style and just...
Having to work around limits like that sometimes creates better effects than you would have if you had more at your disposal.
I think that was a wise decision on the filmmaker's part.
Yeah.
You know, because again, you also get to utilize the imagination of the audience because they don't get to see it, so they're building it up in their own minds.
Do people still have that?
Apparently...
Only what Facebook shows them.
I certainly did when I was a kid. I'm telling you, this movie scared the living crap out of me, so I would watch it over and over. It was one of those movies that would come on all the time on Saturday mornings long ago, Creature Double Feature, Dr. Shock.
Or late night,
You know, and I would love to see it. And my brother at the time liked it as well, so it was one of those movies I could watch with him.
Sure.
So a little bit about the Cryptoid sort of history with this particular film. For Abominable Snowman were sort of like the big thing in the 40s, 50s, and early 60s. So in America, it was very, very different. However, there have been over 1,000 sightings reported of Bigfeet and Yetis and Sasquatches between 1818 and 1980, a third of which are in the Pacific Northwest.
And it's regional.
Yeah, it's very, very regional.
Like Sasquatch is usually always out west mm-hmm. and northwest. So your Seattle, Oregon, Northern California, where Bigfoot was more upstate New York, out through Tennessee and Kentucky.
And they had like skunk apes and all kinds of other things.
Down in Florida.
Right.
Yeah. And in the Carolinas as well.
Sure. Yep. Now, as far as Falk goes, apparently there had been sightings, reported sightings in the newspapers of Falk since the 1940s. So this had actually gone back a while. And as far as films go, you know, like I said, in the 50s, you had Snow Creature, you had The Abominable Snowman, and you had Man Beast. And all of them were set in the Himalayas because at the time, that's all anybody really heard about it as far as a national consciousness goes for Abominable Snowman. And then, you know, and same thing in the 60s, there was a Polish film called Ostrzańcy Yeti, which was a 1961 comedy, which had a people sort of dealing with a comedic yeti. There was a Japanese movie in the 1960 also called Jujin Yuki Otoku, which was some...
Sure.
Yeah, it was a Japanese with a really bad costume.
Outstanding.
A really bad costume. 1963, there was The Monster of the Volcanoes, which was a Mexican film. And also that year, The Terrible Snow Giant. And then 1967, The Snow Devils. But again, these are all either Abominable Snowmen in the Himalayas or out in Asia, or they were sort of local, like the Mexican one was about the Mexican monster.
I had no idea there was that many Abominable Snowmen.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's a ton of stuff out there. It's been out there, but it wasn't until 1967... The Roger Patterson film. You know what I'm talking about.
Patterson-Gimlin, yeah.
That set off sort of an atom bomb in the cryptoid ABSM world. If you don't know about this, this is that famous film where supposedly the rancher shot something like a minute and a half of this abominable snowman walking through the woods.
Yeah, they went out on horseback. Oh, yeah.
The and, sort of grainy footage of the guy.
Right.
They went out on horseback. And shot it, and then they kind of got supposedly surprised by it and had a rush to get their camera out and get a shot of it.
And it was a big, big deal. This, when it happened, it hit all the big shows. So it was on Merv Griffin, it was on Joey Bishop, it was on Johnny Carson. You know, Patterson ended up all over the place. He was world famous. He started doing tours. He wrote a book. He became sort of a big guy, and that sort of refueled the interest in Yetis and about and Bigfoot and all that, but in America, not just out in the Himalayas.
That's still in contention. People still...
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, a lot of scientists have seen it and sort of written it off and said, well, the gate is incorrect and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I don't know.
It seems to be cyclic. A lot of cryptid ones. You'll have... It's kind of like eating meat and sugar. You know, you'll have the periods of where all cryptids are, the gate's wrong, this is bad. And then after a few months, they go into a whole flap of, well, now you can see that not only is the gate right, but it has breasts, which they said of the Patterson-Gimlin film, that it was a female.
Oh, so just like in Suburban Sasquatch with the purple pendulous
it had large, which was probably a direct response to this. And in fact, it was probably... mid-2000s that the Bigfoot Field Research Organization came out with an introspection relook at the Patterson-Gimlin film and really breaking that down.
But it's sort of the event that crystallizes the whole thing. So after that, we have 1972. That's the first, 1970. There's a movie called Bigfoot with John Carradine. It's a piece of crap.
I've seen that. Yeah.
Piece of crap with a crappy... stupid costume, and all that he does is just the same thing as every monster movie. He picks up Joy Langsing and carries her off.
And then masturbates while strangling
him. Well, no, just carries
them. Oh, wait, that was Carradine, my bad. What? Too soon?
Yeah. Okay. But basically what I'm getting at is that it was a typical monster movie of the Hollywood era trying to catch a big buck. Sure. Here in 1972 comes Charles B. Pierce, who completely changes his approach to it and does it more like a sort of a documentary. There was a TV documentary in 1972 called Bigfoot Man or Beast that came on TV and sort of approached it in a similar kind of way. And I don't think it's, you know, a coincidence that these two things came out around 1972. Right. Sort of looking at it more as a, you know, documentary scientific approach as opposed to monster movie of the week that you're just going right. to buy popcorn.
And again, you had In Search yeah. of coming out with right. Leonard Nimoy at that time.
74.
That was 74?
Right.
Yeah.
But this, so this is the one that sets off the whole big wave of all these Yeti and Sasquatch sure. and Bigfoot movies that come later on. So it's kind of a big deal. So that's why I like to make sure that folks, especially from like your generation, get to see a movie like this, because it is so seminal in all these other horror movies to come, all the way up to now. I mean, Bigfoot is still a big underground independent horror movie, you know, source. So
there's even some pretty weird book genres.
Sure.
If you follow me.
Yes.
Just on Sasquatch love.
Right.
We'll put it that way.
Right. There's all kinds of weird stuff.
Did you have to remind me? I found one of those books in a bargain bin, and I didn't know what it was.
Dear.
Oh, one of my friends' podcasts actually interviewed an author that was I guess pretty famous for her Bigfoot erotica.
I remember seeing some of that.
Yeah, I found a book like that in the bargain bin, and I didn't know what it was. Oh, because
outstanding.
It had the same title as a book I'd read in middle school for Battle of the Books. So I opened it up because I liked the book in middle school, and it was not the same book.
That's not the book.
Oh, dear.
Oh, my Lord.
But at least this gives you a little bit more of a background for this particular film, you know, and as far as how it fits in the tradition of independent films and Bigfoot. Unfortunately, Charles B. Pierce died in 2010. This film, it was made on a budget of like $165,000, and it made over $25 million. It was a big deal.
Yeah, that's huge.
It was the 10th highest grossing film of 1972, and that's including all the big Hollywood movies. People went in droves to see this. This was obviously shot and marketed as a drive-in movie. Again, this is before your time, but drive-in movies were sort of quick, dirty, cheapy exploitation films that you threw out there for the teenagers to, you know, have an excuse to kiss their girlfriends and eat some popcorn, and it didn't really matter about right. the quality. But this was shot in a totally different way, and it became a big hit. And it's such a big hit that they actually re-released it in the theaters in 1975. This was amazing. This was
and
like
made
the
more.
It was the little engine that could. It really was. So there's lots of interesting little bits here. Sorry, did you?
Oh, from Thomas the Tank Engine.
Oh, right.
Train engine.
Right, exactly. So the movie itself is kind of a gathering of different separate incidents that are squished together into a single narrative. So like, the attack on the Turner family was an incident in 1971 that happened. It was documented. There are police records. There are, you know, articles from the period discussing what happened. But all the other things that happened were separate little bits and pieces that they decided to sort of string together into the movie and set it as one continuous narrative. So it's very interesting the way that they did it. Margaret Ross wrote in the Arkansas Gazette in an article in 1971 that reports sightings of the Falk monster went back as far as the 1850s.
Oh, yeah.
And in the 40s, there was a series of sightings in the Jonesville, Arkansas area, which was only 10 miles away, known as the Jonesville Monster. So
okay,
people
flap. I've heard of that.
Yeah, so that's very close enough, especially with this territory where all the creeks and things are sort of mixing up. And if you go and you look at a map, you'll notice that, you know, Boggy Creek runs into the Sulphur River. The Red River is to the east of it, to the east of it. And then to the west, the Sulphur River runs into the Sulphur River bottomland. And it's this massive, I guess, I don't know if it's a state reserve or a national reserve or a federal reserve, but it's a gigantic wetland area. That's probably what they were talking about in the film, that's where the creature lived, because there's not going to be anything out there except swamps and trees and
sure.
mud and crap like that. So you can see that if there was something in there, how it would pop up in various places. In 1971, just to give you an example of some of the other stories, the Texarkana Daily News reporter named Dan Ross, he is the guy that said that that he saw when he was driving back from Falk to Texarkana that the hairy monster walked out in front of his car. So that's one of the incidents that happens in the film. It just doesn't happen in the timeline that the film does. He took it from another time and then just kind of strung it together. That's why, while it's based on true events, it's not a true story in and of itself. Some other interesting little bits and pieces. In the first 2 weeks of this film opening in Los Angeles in 1972, it made $500,000.
Wow.
Yeah, it became like a big deal. And such a big deal that this movie was actually added to the American Film Institute catalog of feature films for their first 100 years of film. And it's been preserved. So it's become kind of an important film. And Charles B. Pierce also, I think I mentioned, one of the movies he did was a movie called The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Oh, I've heard of that.
That's a really good film. And that, too, is based on true events. That is based on the 1946 Phantom Killer murders in Texarkana, which is nearby. So this was kind of his stick, was to sort of find these true or true-ish things that happened, unusual things that happened, and then film them. The Evictors is also based on a true tale. Sort of like the way he was doing things there. Let's see. What else did I want to... Oh, yeah, I also wanted to mention your friend and my friend, Ms. Dawn Wells.
Yes.
She is the one who played Marianne in...
My childhood crush.
Yeah, Gilligan's Island. Please tell me you know what Gilligan's Island is.
Is it the same as Gulliver's Travels?
No. Mm-hmm. We will have to educate you on Gilligan's Island.
Yeah.
It was like a phenomenon. But she played Marianne, and she's wonderful. She did not play in The Legend of Boggy Creek. However, in 1977, she was in a movie called Return to Boggy Creek, which Charles B. Pierce had nothing to do with, unfortunately. She also appeared in Charles B. Pierce's later movies, The Barbaric Beast of Boggy Swamp in 1985, and... let's see. I think he did another one as well. But anyway, and she was also in the original Town That Dreaded Sundown. Oh. So there's a Dawn Wells connection going on in the film, too.
Dawn.
I don't know. The other thing I wanted to mention was that in 1971, there was an archaeological professor in Southern Arkansas University who examined the casts of the footprints that were taken from the Falk Mouncer from the original sightings. And he, according to him, it was 99% sure that they were faked.
They were faked.
And, you know, doing some more research, they definitely pulled out some of the things that we had discussed as far as, you know, the monster turning the knobs and putting his hand through the window and how Yeah, that's probably been faked.
Even if the flap may have happened and something may have been out there, someone very easily could have said, I'm going to use this as a way to...
Sure.
If at best terrorize people and at worst...
Because
harm people.
At the exact same time that the, you know, Yeti and Bigfoot craze started to hit in the 70s, it's also the same time when all the fake Bigfoot sightings and stuff, because people are going to go out there, they're going to make fake feet, they're going to put on stupid suits, they're going to just try to ride it for all it's worth.
And, that's why the analysis of prints have gotten so much more exact, where they're actually now looking for such as fingerprints, but for your toes, so toe prints. Scars, broken digits on the feet, which they have found, ones that are missing a toe or only has part of a toe. So that's what they're kind of looking and taking more seriously in that.
Anything non-symmetrical?
Hmm?
Or just things, just non-symmetrical prints in general?
Right.
Right, exactly.
Because it's not going to be exactly the same each
time. Exactly.
Right, and then you look at it from an anthropological point of view and you think, well, there's nothing that's that size that could be feeding on the local whatever's in the environment.
Right.
You know,
depending on the size of the wood.
Right. And plus three toes. The only thing it really comes to mind is a three-toed sloth, which clearly this is nothing like that.
Or an ostrich.
Right. So there are no hominids that had three toes on it. No. So there's Yeah, there's
to be able to keep that kind of a gait and run.
Right. So there's definitely some conflation going on, but
yeah.
It's just interesting because somewhere along the line, people have been talking stories about this sort of thing, you know, back since the 1850s,
oh,
right,
sure.
And before with Native Americans. So I just find it fascinating. You go to most any culture, and they're going to have stories and mythology dealing with giants and
even
monsters.
Down in South America with the, what is that, the Orinpendek.
Mm-hmm.
Is that South America?
I don't remember.
I think it was.
Every culture has its other.
Right.
You know, and that's sort of its point, is to say we are us and we have this culture, and then there's the other who are monsters and who are wild men and who
are boogeyman.
Right, they're our boogeyman, and that's exactly what this comes from. This is that sort of brought to life.
And you see it kind of not as center now because there's so many other real observable boogeymen
right.
world now. It's terrorists are boogeymen.
But the good thing at the time is that Charles B. Pierce, again, he just chose to do it from a very different point of view. You know, the film opens up where he's talking about being a little kid and remembering this horrible screams that he would hear from the woods when he was a kid and how that would freak him out. And then he comes back, and because of the stuff that's been going on in 1971, and it's a series of interviews, and they're all interviewing some of the local people saying, well, we found these footprints, or I saw this shadow, or I saw something jump out. You know, there's nothing sensationalistic about it, nothing, you know, monster of the week kind of a thing. It's more like we don't really know what this is.
Right.
And the way that the local people approach it is very realistic. You know, they get their hunting dogs to go out and look for it.
Right.
And the hunting dogs smell it. As soon as they smell it, they're like, we're not going near that damn thing.
Right.
You know, people who see it have very, very brief encounters and pretty much just run away.
Yeah.
You know, so
that's another very common thing with sightings of Bigfoot, is that feeling of unbridled fear.
Right.
Even if you're not there, the hair stands up on your neck and you have this fear like, what is here? I'm not seeing anything. And then they would have the sighting.
But a very different way of handling it than, say, your normal Hollywood or normal B movies would do, where they're just monsters tearing things apart and abducting women and just doing all kinds of stupid shit.
Yeah.
Because they're not approaching it like a monster of the week.
No. I wonder if you...
Go ahead.
If you were to, like, encounter an ape or something in the wild, would you react the same way?
Right.
Probably you would.
Mm-hmm.
Because...
Even going back to... Poe, Murders of the Rue Morgue, involved a large bipedal, escaped gorilla or escaped
ape
of some sort.
It's a really good movie in that regard, and it sort of, you know, had a very fresh, different approach. So then the movie continues on again in sort of this documentary way, and different locals talk about things that happened. And then different reactions, I think one of the little kids shoots at it and hits it. The monster does something what I think was very natural. It vanishes for 8 years.
Right.
It goes back. They assume that it goes back deeper into the woods and just doesn't want to come around because it feels it's been threatened, which seems perfectly natural to me.
Yeah.
And then everybody's talk sort of dies down and people think, oh, you know, it must be gone. And people start going back into the woods. And then all of a sudden, boom, it's returned. And that's when the sightings become a lot more violent. And then it leads up to the actual documented event that happened in 1971 with the Turner family sort of replayed out. And, you know, even... the details for that incident are kind of fuzzy. You know, again, the whole thing where it's you know, somehow utilizing the doorknob. Come on.
Yeah, no, that's a stretch.
Where it's been shot a few times, but it doesn't seem to be bothered. Yeah, I don't know about that. The one guy does claim to have physically been assaulted by the creature, and then he had to go to the hospital. He apparently did go to the hospital, but... you know, I don't know whatever really happened beyond that.
He was in shock.
Yeah.
He recovered quickly.
But it's interesting is because, you know, everybody started to go down to Arkansas, that part of Arkansas, after that movie came out.
Again,
I wanted to go.
Now it has a trade.
I never wanted to set foot in Arkansas in my life. But I saw that film and I'm like, man, wouldn't it be cool to go down to Falk and go check it out? I mean, who wouldn't want to see that?
Right.
So it became sort of like a big deal. And I think if you even go down there today, you can go to like a local gas station and they'll be selling. They'll be selling relics or, you know, souvenirs and stuff.
Then most recently was Mammoth Cave National Park in Kentucky.
Oh.
There was a sighting of a large bipedal creature, and it actually drew some gunfire because you're in Kentucky.
America.
Right, right. So.
We like to shoot things here.
We shoot things here. So
that's our scientific investigation.
Shoot it. We'll figure it out later.
I have shown you a lot of monster type movies. This is a very different approach, don't you think?
Yeah.
Were there parts that of the movie that you liked?
The end credits.
That would be mean. To be honest, I don't think the movie just had that big an impression on me in general. Mm-hmm.
There's a man named Corky. Everyone loves that.
Oh, God.
Yeah,
Corky.
I didn't really dislike it. I just didn't like it either. I'm neutral towards it.
Kind of neutral towards it.
That's okay. Fair.
All right. Yeah, it's kind of a slow burn kind of a movie. And I guess there are people who don't like it because of the fact that it doesn't approach it like a Hollywood Monster of the Week kind of a thing. So I guess there's something to be said for that. But this also has a lot of nostalgia for myself and probably for you.
Oh, it absolutely was one of the movies.
That you're not getting.
Along with Sasquatch Legend of Bigfoot in 77.
Right.
In Search Of, that really got me into bizarre things. Mm-hmm. Cryptology, UFOs, strange phenomena, high strangeness.
Right. And that was kind of a big thing in the 70s and early 80s. And this is sort of the genus for all that. So, yeah, it's a movie. It's important. But it's also, to me, it's kind of a fun movie. And it's just different. Now, I thought the movie was pretty damn creepy. The fact that everything looked realistic. Like, you could just drive right down and meet all these people. You could meet the crab trees and the wall ravens and
that little cafe they talk about where the guys just come out to talk about fish.
Right. Like, these people are real. That makes what happens seem real, too.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's verisimilitude. And that's where I think the movie's really, really strong.
That grown-up, gummo-looking dude who lived in the shack.
Herb,
who didn't believe in any of it.
Right, and that was funny. That played against it.
That's reality right there.
And it's funny because I remember as a kid thinking, oh yeah, this old coot's been living in the backwoods. He's probably been playing checkers with it.
Right,
And he comes out and he's like, I never saw that thing. No such thing exists.
Right.
And he's probably right. He probably knows, at least instinctively, that you can't have something like that, what they're talking about.
Right.
That it's just made up.
But I heard screams. It was a fox, kid. Have you ever heard of fox? It's a fox.
Yeah, it could be just about anything. But
sure.
Peacocks.
Oh, peacocks, whippoorwills.
Right. Oh, my goodness.
Actually, how many toes do peacocks have? Or do they have webbed toes?
I don't know.
I've never gotten that close to one because they're so creepy sounding.
It's true.
I've never looked at their feet. I'd assume they're a 3 foot like a ostrich or something like that, but I don't know.
But I don't know that they would have that large size. Right.
Now, one of the cryptologist theories for some of the prints in bear areas is that bear prints look very human, just in large scale. But the way they walk is their hind foot, front foot will place, and then their hind foot will step partially where the front foot was, extending the foot to a much longer.
Well, and that's a very good point, because the other thing about these prints is, unless you're getting them pretty fresh, the odds are that you're going to get distortions.
Especially in snow.
Yeah, absolutely. But in mud, you know, these things are wet. Right. They dry out. They contract. Traction. They expand. Yeah. They warp. So unless you're fresh, you're not going to get a true print.
Not at all.
So that's another thing about that particular area of research. But I wanted to touch a little bit more about the way the film was shot. One of the things I really liked, and it's unfortunate that we only had the DVD version, and one of the things I wanted to bring up is the fact that Charles B. Pierce's daughter got the rights back last year, and in January they're going to be putting out the 4K and Blu-ray version of this film where it's cleaned up. And I have seen clips from it on YouTube, and I'm telling you, it looks gorgeous.
And when is that coming out? Next year?
If it hasn't come out already, it's this month sometime,
oh,
I believe.
I definitely have to get a copy.
I definitely would love to see it, and because, like you said, all we've ever seen over the years has been these very grainy, sort of crappy versions of the film, and it's a really cool, beautiful film. I mean, he went down to this area,
right,
which is a national preserve, and it looks gorgeous. All the animals, you know, all the trees, all the water.
The use of locals and high school students, right, the from the area.
Sunsets. I mean, it looks like a very beautiful film.
Yeah.
Had it been shot on like a Hollywood budget, they probably would have had, you know, great cinematography and high-end film. But, you know, he was the local guy,
sure,
using what he could. But to have it all cleaned up would be a huge, huge thing. And then the second thing I wanted to point out is the sound. The sound in the film is extremely realistic, and that's because he went out there with his microphones and he would attach them to trees and leave them overnight. So he was capturing all the real wild, right, sounds of that area of the wood, of
which
the world.
Was that era's kind of introduction to almost like our trail cams that we have now.
Sure, sure. Or the folio time sounds or things.
Sure.
So, again, you're adding these layers of realism with the people, with the sounds, with the settings, with the imagery that you're seeing to help build the case that there really is this monster out there that is a mystery that nobody knows about. People have seen little bits and pieces of, little fleeting experiences with, and that it could really well be out there. And I think he talks about the real theme of the film at the very end. Remember, he comes back and he's walking in the same bean field that he was running in as a kid. There's that wonderful moment. And he goes back to his old homestead that's now sort of been abandoned and it's just sitting there, and he's rethinking about it. And he says for a second, I almost want to hear his horrible, lonely cry one more time, just as a way to remind me that there is still a bit of wilderness left in the world, that there are still mysteries out there that we don't understand as human beings, and that, you know, that world still that's important to him and to a lot of other people still exists, that sort of world of imagination.
Yeah, right. So the question there is, how close does he want to hear it?
Well, as an adult, you know, it's one thing. Certainly as a child, and again, I think I mentioned I was about that 7-year-old seems when I first saw it, and it scared the living crap out of me.
I'm not sure I was one yet, so I was little when it came out, but I know I definitely saw it through my childhood.
Yeah, and you know, it's seeing it from a kid's eyes in the darkness by yourself. It's a whole, you know, different story, especially since I had a patch of woods nearby, and woods are creepy places. You live near woods, right?
I used to live in the woods.
There you go. So you understand about weird noises and weird things happening in the woods.
Yeah. My sister and I lived on the second floor of a farmhouse in the middle of nowhere, just completely surrounded by woods, except for this one road. And we didn't have any real neighbors or anyone nearby. And sometimes we'd wake up in the middle of the night and there'd be like this face in the window.
Really?
And we were on the second floor. Couldn't have been a person. And we're not sure what it was.
A giraffe?
It looked like it was made from leaves or something.
Oh,
but
yeah,
it was, like, not leaves. It wasn't from a tree or anything. We don't know what it was.
Well, I'm sure there were interesting sounds in the middle of the night, too.
Oh, yeah.
So, that one scene, one of the early scenes where there's that high school girl with her older older sister who's got the new baby and the mother, and they're all three in the house. And she goes out to draw water from the well. And we're all like, is that a well?
It's right.
Yeah, it is, because these are people living in the middle of nowhere, literally in the middle of the woods.
Right.
And the narrator is telling you, there's no telephone here. There's nobody around for at least a mile. These people are by themselves. And the drama unfolds where the monster comes out. The girl sees it, freaks out. The poor kitty that was out there, like...
Aww.
Screams,
drops dead
from fright.
Poor kitty.
And you believe it because it's like, oh my god,
right,
this is scary as shit.
So where did that kitty corpse come from?
I don't know.
I think
you just find some roadkill.
Probably.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was a puppet.
It could have been a puppet.
It could have been.
Or you know, a Halloween store.
That's one of those things that, yeah, you know, in the Blu-ray, you might be able to see things a little clearer.
Right.
I did notice towards the end when they did the Turner thing where Bobby is being jostled by the monster, you can kind of see a mask on the actor.
I know the part is like a flash of the face.
Right. And, you know, but yeah. Otherwise...
It's either a mask or it was Pazuzu. I'm not sure.
Otherwise, I thought they did a very good job with the monster in general, with keeping us at a distance, not letting us get a good, clear glimpse of it, just like those folks would.
Right.
You know? And then, let's see, what else did I want to mention? There was, I had it.
I even had a great quote that I wanted to talk about, and I completely forgot to write it down.
I know. We're getting old.
There's some good ones in there.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, what did you think of the monster's scream?
It sounded like peacocks to me.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I've never heard a peacock scream.
Peacocks are unnerving. They're different than usual Bigfoot scream. But there's... The Bigfoot noises have gotten so out of hand that now any knock in the woods is a wood knock or tree knock. And any widowmaker that had fallen from the treetops and leaned against a tree is now it's an obvious dwelling. And any kind of scream or whoop or noise that doesn't sound like anything you're used to, like foxes and peacocks. And though peacocks are pretty rare for just roaming around your average wood or bog,
mm-hmm.
fox and mating mountain lion are pretty unnerving.
To be honest, I've never heard those two, but I have heard peacocks before. Yeah. Well, I've never knowingly heard foxes, although I've lived in areas where there were foxes.
Foxes just sound like women screaming.
You remember when I first moved here and I started hearing that weird thing.
Which we never got a...
And I heard it for like 10 years.
Right, and then gone.
And then it was gone. Now, it was this really weird thing that sounded like three different things mushed together. But... It would move. It would move up the creek, and then it would come close to the house, and then it would move away. And then I recorded it, and I actually sent it off to the Commonwealth of Virginia. To somebody, a zoologist.
And they didn't know either.
They couldn't identify it. They had no idea what it was. And they're like, are you sure you didn't, like, take a couple of sounds and put them together? I was like, no.
It does. It sounded harmonic. It sounded like a chorus. There were multiple noises at once. So the only thing I can think of is that it was a camp of Himalayan throat singers living in the woods behind your house.
It was very strange and unusual. And I used to, because I used to sleep with my window open,
right,
especially when it was cooler, because I liked having the cool air come in. So I would hear it. I would say at least once a week. You could hear it coming all the way up, and then it would get close, and it would kind of hang out for a little bit, and then it would go away. And it did this for 10 years. And then all of a sudden...
Just gone.
It was just gone.
Did that coincide with them starting to tear those woods down?
Yeah, roughly.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know what that could have been. But, you know, who knows?
Who knows?
Creatures make a lot of weird sounds. Now, I may be very wrong about this, but my gut feeling tells me that most animals make vocalizations either to announce their territory, to chase other rivals away, or looking for mates.
To woo women.
And I don't know that mammals do much of that mate calling thing, other than maybe some cats.
I don't know, yeah.
Or, you know, I don't know. I would think most of those things are territorial, but then if you're, and they keep talking about this being its only creature, it's only one of its kind, it kind of doesn't need to be territorial. The whole world is its territory.
But, I mean, they can use it for communication.
But you got to have somebody to communicate with.
Just wolves have so many different types of barks, yelps, stuff that they can communicate back and forth
mm-hmm.
with each other. And I guess gorillas and chimpanzees and bonobos all do the same.
Right.
But some of them are...
but they know that they're out there. You know, right. They know others are out, of their kind are out there. Whereas this particular thing... And then here's the other thing. If you're a species... How do you live alone with nothing else to procreate with?
You don't.
And still live for hundreds of years.
Another reason I could have left for 8 years is they do track Bigfoot sighting types, and they found similar print patterns where, okay, this one was missing this toe, you know, and then they find it 1,000 miles somewhere else this time of year, a similar one also missing that very same toe in the same way that they think there may be a migration pattern.
Mm.
But Again, but you don't know.
In order to be a viable species, right. you need to have a certain population level.
Sure.
In order to procreate and to not,
right.
you know, be a bunch of, you
and
know.
There's a lot of literature on pros and against that idea that they could not.
Yeah, I mean, clearly there has to be a population. If there's a population,
right.
the larger the chance of sightings. And, you know, there's no way, even today, that you can be completely hidden. Certainly not in the United States.
Right.
I mean, maybe in the Himalayas.
And then oddly enough, out of nowhere, when that becomes propagated, that idea, now you're seeing families of Bigfoot, small right. Bigfoot right. ones, large Bigfoot, seeing mother and child or a large male and child.
Yeah, there's too many red flags and too much science against the idea of cryptoids and abominable snowmen and all that.
And either sides can argue until the cows
however, I still love movies about it because I just think it's cool.
Right.
Yeah. In the same way I love movies about ghosts and vampires, even though I don't know they don't exist, I just think they're cool.
The mountain gorillas had the same thing where they were reporting seeing one here, one there, and then found out that there was a large, huge population of
them. A bigly huge
population of them. And this could be, whether it's Gigantopithecus remnants or not, we don't know. But then they
is that that huge, giant species of ape?
Prehistoric ape, yeah.
Where they only have the jaw.
But again, not with three toes.
None with three toes, but there are flaps of these three-toed sightings, but I don't give them much. I don't know a lot about them, but I don't give them a lot of credit because it doesn't make sense.
Right. And, you know, the lack of dead specimens, the lack of any real forensic or physical evidence, it's, you know.
That's why they came up with the term, was it blob squatch? Right. Every time you get a picture, it's a blurry blob.
But it doesn't really matter because there's enough left to the imagination that we as horror movie aficionados want to be scared. And this is a great and rich vein which to tap to talk about these stories and to sort of go into that. And,
sure.
You know, I like kind of the fact that this was very different than your typical abominable snowman in the Himalaya stuff. This was very different than the Native American Sasquatch in the Pacific Northwest.
Sure.
Very different. It has its own flavor.
Yep.
It has its own sort of series and own sort of twists that don't really coincide with anything else. It's extremely regional. And I rather like that about this particular film. And, you know, like I said, to this day, it still drives people into that area just to go down there and, you know, maybe see something.
And squatch hunt.
So, and I think if Charles B. Pierce were alive today, he would get a big smile out of that because, you know, he made this little drive-in film that became a phenomenon that ended up, you know, creating this huge wave of lesser and crappier, you know, Yeti and Bigfoot movies.
Right. Close to you is the Lake Anna flap of Bigfoot sightings. On Lake Anna, they had prints and sightings went for about a mile and a half.
Virginia?
Yeah, up near Fredericksburg.
Oh, okay.
In Lake Anna. And they had footprints. Again, they were bilaterally different, and one was slightly larger than the other foot. There was dermal ridges, and then it's gone.
Well,
but the other thing, you can make a silicone foot.
Right.
Put on your shoe with silicone ridges. And
the other thing I wonder about too is if I wonder how much of the Lucy prints, you know, sort of factor into this too. You know, the famous footprints that they found in Africa.
Got to be in the consciousness.
You know, it's sure it's got to be part of it in there someplace.
And then both sides can argue. Well, then that proves it because Lucy left prints. Therefore, Bigfoot has left prints.
Right. Well,
you know, and the reverse.
The difference being that the Lucy ones are millions of years old. And this was last Tuesday in Billy Bob's cornfield with a cigarette butt in the middle of it.
Well, obviously, Billy Bob only saw that because his corn was growing ergo. Not growing wheat. So it was wheat,
It's funny. But, so I don't know. To me, this was always kind of a really cool movie. You know, like I said, it's got a lot of nostalgia effects. To explain part of it, but I just like the way that it was done. It does have some corniness to it. Some of the music is pretty damn corny.
Oh boy.
You know, I mean, I liked it as a kid, but, you know, I couldn't help but chuckle at it.
I didn't remember how corny it was just from the last time I saw it a few years ago, and I'm like, whoa, that song's bad.
Yeah, very.
Jimmy Bob lives down on the bayou and eats.
Travis Crabtree song is a little silly, and I kind of like the other song too. It's a little wistful, and you know, it's very folky, sort of down woodsy. But yeah, it's sort of today's audience. It's gonna undermine people. I'm sure you thought it was hokey as heck.
A little, yeah. But, I mean, I've had my it wasn't Bigfoot at all, but I've had my own experiences that I wasn't sure about.
Really? Do tell.
So this was during that whole scare where people were dressing up as clowns to scare people.
Oh, yeah.
Which, to be honest, kind of just fizzled out.
Clownopithecus.
But it was on a college campus, and me, my boyfriend, my sister, and her best friend were there with us. And we were walking out from the back entrance of the cafeteria, which itself faced the woods and the old part of campus that no one really uses anymore. And the back entrance to the campus that also wasn't really used. And as we were walking out, we heard clown music, but like the creepy slowed down clown music. A little like that, yeah.
Calliope music. Nice. I'm out at Calliope music. I'm like, sorry, I can't stay.
And we were just looking at each other and said, okay, that's a little odd. And then we tried to figure out where it was coming from, and it was coming from the woods and that old part of campus that no one used. And it's like, okay, that's a little weird. And if we tried to investigate further, we're going to be the dumb people in those horror movies that gets killed. So let's not investigate.
Somewhere there's a brand new guy with a new ice cream truck going, where are all the students? Why is this empty?
That is one thing we considered.
There is a topic for Indie Film Cafe. If we could come up with a Bigfoot clown. But, how about that?
Bigfoot clowns from outer space.
There you go.
But there's more to the story. But that's the first thing we considered was that there might have been a neighborhood nearby we weren't aware of that had a...
ice cream man.
Yeah. But we kept hearing it, and it got creepier sounding, and it started lasting longer. I was like, okay, at this point, we may as well just investigate. So we got into Jess's car.
Was it a van with like...
mystery machine?
Yeah.
No.
Did you have a dog with you?
We should have, but
you
we didn't.
Have, yeah.
But we got into the car and we drove down that old road. And it's like, as we were driving down, there was like bogish creek river areas on both sides. And we could hear frogs and some kind of insect and bats. Bats and stuff. It's like, okay, from far away, this could probably be distorted.
Where did you go to school?
And could probably sound North like clown Carolina. Music.
Oh,
and then as we were driving further, we noticed all of these blinking lights and we realized, oh shit, those are motion sensing cameras. What the hell is going on? Why are they aimed at this
entry? You're in a black site.
Why is it aimed at this empty road?
There are a bunch of terrorists in tents and they just keep playing Calliope music until they go insane and emit things.
And then as we were driving past again, as we're driving out of it, we heard the music again. I was like, okay, this is actually getting kind of creepy. We're not going to do this again. And we still have no idea what that was.
Where did you go to school?
North Carolina, Fayetteville.
Fayetteville?
Fayetteville.
Near Fort Bragg. It's a very weird place.
Oh, my God, it's near Fort Bragg.
Yeah, so.
You're totally, it was some weird.
Tons and tons and tons
psyops.
Of ticks.
I bet Fort Bragg has a psyops center.
Possibly.
But yeah, we heard the clown music a few times after that, but again, I've been up here for a while. I haven't been at that school for a few months, so I don't know.
No.
But we heard it a few times after that, and we were like, okay, yep, yeah, we're not going there again. Let's just keep going.
But it just further underscores how being in the woods and hearing weird stuff can really creep you out.
Especially if it's at a distance or something's distorting it.
Right, right, right. Well, you didn't find any clown shoe prints there, did you, by any chance?
We weren't getting out of the car to look.
Three-toed clowns? That would be very interesting.
We stayed in the car.
How far from Fort Bragg are you?
Close enough the ground rattles when they do the shots and stuff.
Was it May? Was it early spring?
Yeah.
They have a carnival and a fair every May, apparently.
There you go.
It could have been.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there you go. That could be the explanation.
The first thing that comes up, top clowns for hire in Fayetteville, North Carolina.
I guess that was what it was.
The forest clowns of North Carolina.
Still doesn't explain what the motion sensing cameras were for, but we weren't getting out of the car to investigate. We decided that we'd be safer in the car.
Well, in this particular film, I mean, we're talking zero technology here. I mean, these are people living in the middle of nowhere without even phones, without even running water. They had to draw water from a well. You know, do you remember we noticed every building was pretty much a shack. with electricity, a glorified shack with electricity, and the animals were living in little lean-tos that were locally built that looked very not much different than what the humans were living in. So rather primitive, and all of this adds to the idea that this is real, that this that there really is something out there, and what we're watching is not a pseudo documentary, but a real documentary. So to me, I thought that this is a really good example of how you can build something to make it look real without it necessarily being real, because of course it really isn't, but it's okay. That's not what it's not what the point of the movie is.
That's what you ran into.
What is this?
That's the fourth PSYOP group at Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Anyway, so getting back to the film, I guess we're at about the time when we can wrap this up. So again, this is a movie that always sort of stuck with me and has always been a favorite. And, you know, if I ever managed to somehow spawn or procreate, I think I would show this to my kids and hope that maybe, you know, they'd get a real scare out of it. Gary, you've always kind of liked this film, haven't you?
I did. I always did like it. Again, for those very same reasons, that it really was one of the first ones to break Bigfoot down in more of a scientific's really kind of a stretch, but to take a kind of a serious look at Bigfoot,
right,
things other than just in your weird bookstore while you're looking for, you know, Chariots of the Gods or something like that.
Right. It was a drive-in film that was not shot like a drive-in film.
Right. Which makes it all the scarier.
Sure. And people responded. I mean,
yeah.
$25 million for a $165,000 production says an awful, awful lot. It's probably one of the most successful drive-in theater movies ever made. And you can see why it spawned, you know, all these different following movies later on.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So, nothing...
Since a lot of people in a lot of regions have some version of Bigfoot, that's probably why it was so popular.
Sure.
Because it's universally kind of accepted of like, oh, well, we have this or we have that. We have the swamp ape. We have the skunk ape. We have Orem Pendek. We have this. So every community in the U.S. can relate, if nothing more than having heard of it or seen it.
And even like the writer says towards the end, even if you don't believe in it, it's fine because you kind of sort of want to, or you enjoy it anyway because, you know, it's just, it's a bit of imagination and it's a bit of fun and it's something that we all sort of universally like and respond to.
Absolutely.
So, you know? Well, I guess that's about it for this particular film. Thank you for listening to it. Thank you to my co-hosts here, Lenore and Gary.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was fun.
I'm glad that you enjoyed it, even though you were kind of... on the fence about it, kind of meh.
Yeah.
See if I can't find you a more scary film for later on. This one was, you know, an old favorite for nostalgia purposes, and I really kind of wanted to touch on it in the first season of Forgotten Horror Classics. There's a bunch of movies that we're going to end up doing at some point, and we hadn't done anything quite like this before, so I thought this was about the time for that. At some point, I would love to do the other really good Charles B. Pierce movie, the original Town That Dreaded Sundown. I thought it was a very, very good film. It's very similar in the way that it's approached. But of course, that's about the Phantom Killings in the 1940s. So it's very different. Actually, as I recall, poor Don Wells gets like shot in the face.
No!
Yeah, I know. It's a shame. No. But survives.
That's going to traumatize me.
So weren't you going to maybe possibly interview her?
Hoping to actually have her on my show, but I will let you know.
Please let me know. I'm dying to talk to her about this.
I think it would be a good chance for us to do like a double show.
Sure.
You know, and have you on here. Because I don't want to just talk to her about Gilligan's Island.
Right.
She has so much other great work and
things
about her that... I think it would be great.
And most people don't know about them. Most people don't know any about these films. And so I'd love to be able to talk to her about it. I'd love to hear what she had to say about working with Charles Pierce and working with these stories in that area. I think it's fascinating. So maybe we'll get a chance to send her a copy or send her a link to this podcast and she can check it out.
Right.
That'd be great. I'd be honored. Okay, gang, thanks very much for listening to this month's version of Forgotten Horror Classics. Please join us again, and we will try and dig up another old, forgotten, overlooked movie from the past that I think you should check out. Thanks very much, and we will see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.